I'm Mike Brown, author, nerd, and host of the Dark Poutine podcast. Join me and Morgan Knudsen, author, paranormal researcher, and host of the TV shows Paranormal 911 and Haunted Hospitals, as we take you on a journey for the curious about the unseen, the mysterious, and the incredible things happening in the world about us. Welcome to Supernatural Circumstances. Have you ever picked up the phone only to find the person you're about to call is already on the line and the phone hasn't even rung yet? Have you had a dream about something that later on came true? Has someone just out of the blue started talking about something that's been on your mind almost word for word? I have. We all have, if we're honest about it. What's with that? Are these merely coincidences in an otherwise random world like the skeptics would have you believe? Or is there something more cosmic to it? Some people call it ESP. In this episode, Morgan dives into the topic with gusto, and later we have a conversation with the always fascinating Nancy Zingroni, a research fellow at Parapsychology Foundation, Inc., and professor at North Central University. Here's Morgan.
Psychokinesis, precognition, ESP. What do these four things have in common, if anything? Why should we, as paranormal researchers, even begin to care? Well, because the explanation for all of them has not only likely been discovered, but it has also one common and important thread: quantum particle physics and neuroscience. Now, most people hear those words and immediately shut down. Rocket science stuff, right? Well, sometimes. But I want to introduce you to the man who figured this all out, okay? Dr. William Rohl. Lived from 1926 to about 2012. So we here as students of the paranormal have to take a huge pause in what we're doing in order to understand what he has published, okay? I mean a huge pause. Drop everything you thought you knew right now. Turn off the TV shows and start listening. In the final years of his life, William G. Rohl spent most of his last years making sense of psi phenomenon, narrowing it down to two areas of interconnectedness which he felt was particularly relevant: quantum physics and neuroscience. Rohl's thinking had much to do with the late Michael Persinger, who passed away in 2018, so anyone familiar with his work will recognize it. But I hope that within the next few paragraphs, I can explain this in a way that will change how you look at psi forever. And yeah, I'm quite serious. And no, it's not an exaggeration. So, let's start here. In parapsychology, there are two basic types of psi. The first is receptive psi, better known as extrasensory perception, or ESP. It comes from several forms: telepathy, precognition, clairvoyance, psychometry, etc. The second is expressive psi, also known as PK or psychokinesis, and can be described in terms of macroscopic and microscopic PK, so affecting the world we see and then the world we see under a microscope. Now, Erwin Schrödinger lived from 1887 to 1961, proposed that in 1935, according to quantum theory, if a subatomic particle is split in half, the two resulting particles will be forever connected or entangled. So, no matter where one goes, no matter the distance, those two halves will always be responsive to the other. Think of it like identical twins. One is always tied to the other, right? No matter where they are in the world. He proposed this theory in response to an article written by the great Albert Einstein, Boris Podolsky, and Nathan Rosen, who described a thought experiment originally designed to refute the idea of quantum physics, now known as the EPR experiment. The basic idea behind EPR was this: those twins that we just discussed aren't dependent on what the other twin is doing. Instead, the actions of the second twin is dependent upon what your observation expects. Confused yet? Don't worry, I'll explain. Think of each twin, each half of the particle, as spinning coins. You've already observed the first one, which landed on heads. You can only observe one at a time, so the other coin is still spinning. Only your focus will make it stop. This spinning is called being in superposition. It is neither on heads or tails. The coin will spin until your attention causes it to stop. Which side it will land on depends on something very specific. Your observation, not random chance. The realization that mere observation can bring about the collapse of a superposed system seems pretty weird. How can observation do that? The observer's gaze shouldn't affect the object, right? Well, in EPR, it's the other way around, and it absolutely can. The physicist Pascual Jordan described it as such. Observations not only disturb what has to be measured, they produce it. We compel the photon to assume a definite position. We ourselves produce the result of the measurement. This is also known as the observer effect, and it is a persistent issue in these experiments. Oh, and one more thing about the EPR experiment before we go any further. It is a conscious human being that makes it work. A machine can't do the EPR job by itself. Now, hackles tend to get raised when we bring up the word consciousness. But a straightforward explanation of all this is that it requires conscious observation in order for this to work. Jordan later added the following statement. I close these expositions concerning the interpretation of quantum theory with the reproduction of a brief conversation I had with an important theoretical physicist. He said, I am inclined to believe in telepathy. And I said, this has probably more to do with physics than with psychology. It seems Einstein had kept an open mind after all. So, what does this mean for the paranormal? Well, everything. Think of a hotel. You see it in your head? Good. You walk into the lobby. You can only pick one room, right? Now, imagine every single hotel room is a different probability. There are an infinite numbers of them. It's a big hotel. There are all versions of the thing you were focusing on. They have different layouts, different furniture, different pictures on the walls. But they're all versions of the room that you want. The more you focus on one room or one probability, decision, or prediction, the other rooms begin to collapse. Those other rooms disappear until you are left standing in one room. Your observation of that room makes it real. Until you decide on it or observe it, it remains like all the others, spinning in superposition, waiting for observation. So what does this have to do with psychokinesis and ESP? To understand that, we have to take this one step further into something called Josephson's version of quantum theory, named from a concept developed by Josephson, where they propose that life itself has its own way of acting and observing, known as ESP and psychokinesis. Can nature make a decision? The parallels between quantum and biosystems are there, and understanding how this can occur in nature comes down to understanding the observer. You as the observer can choose whether you want to put your attention on one hotel room or another. You are free to enter one and leave another. When you choose one course of action over another, you thereby collapse the wave function of the physical things in the environment, because it's spinning again, except that in this case of physical objects, what is collapsed is matter waves. It is the same with PK, the psi equivalent of action. So let's jump back to EPR for a second and rope in precognition here. In EPR, the observer looks at the other half of the particle, the other twin, and thereby stops it spinning in superposition. To put this in context with precognition, any event can be composed of these two same halves, the physical event and the perception of the event. These two halves make up what we know as present time. The event in the future is, of course, still spinning in superposition until it is decided on or recognized by the observer, which is you. In other words, the percipient would not inspect a pre-existing physical event, as it appears psychics are doing. Instead, they would observe one of the hotel room probabilities that are spinning in superposition. That recognition and observation makes it real. It stops the spinning and actualizes that probability, making it reality. Which event and probability you get depends on a few things, but it all comes back to the observer. So, your biases, expectations, wants, dislikes, likes, everything. It will fill in all the gaps to create your probability and therefore your upcoming reality. As soon as you or the psychic sees that reality, guess what? Unless you shift your attention and create something new by focusing on something else, you might just get what's predicted. If this brings about the collapse of a wave function and the object of attention becomes a part of reality's present as we're suggesting, precognition brings about the collapse of a potential event in the future, which will turn a future event into an event in the present. In other words, it is the precognitive experience that makes the event occur at all. To say that precognition makes something in the future happen doesn't necessarily mean anything in the future can happen. Nancy Sandow introduced a brilliant analogy in 1988 after having a series of precognitive dreams herself, and it went like this. The trunk of a tree represents the present, and all the branches represent possible futures. When the tree becomes and turns into a bunch of branches, then one branch represents the possible future, and others a probability. Assuming the branches are evenly divided, at each division there is a 50-50 split as to which one might occur. The farther up the tree the vision, the less likely it is to happen. However, on a rare occasion that one of those distant and tall branches is indeed reached, the vision would or can be as detailed as the branch right next to you and close to the trunk. This breakthrough in the understanding of precognition and ESP is absolutely huge. It also translates into the realm of paranormal investigation, as current notions of prediction and experimentation are now called into question. We have to begin to re-examine how we are progressing as researchers and begin to shed many old notions about how we view paranormal activity. We are inexplicably connected to all we are experiencing, and we cannot remove ourselves from that equation. As long as you are an observer, which you always will be, you will influence your reality and results. So, the next time you step out into a haunted place or sit down with a psychic, keep in mind, you get what you ask for, even when it's unconscious.
Whoa, there's a lot to think about in what Morgan just said there. Holy smokes. I guess now is the perfect time to insert this conversation that we had with Nancy Zingroni. She is so interesting and digs further into this stuff. My mind is just constantly blown.
I'm so grateful to have such an amazing guest on today and to be able to introduce Nancy Zingroni to the world and to my co-host here, Mike Brown.
Yay!
Nancy has a Bachelor of Arts with honors in psychology, a Master's of Science in Education, specializing in higher education with a teaching specialty in psychology, was a doctoral candidate in history with a focus on the histories of science and medicine, and has a PhD in psychology where her dissertation utilized the methodologies of history and the rhetoric of science, has a discursive psychology to study debates over the legitimacy of parapsychology research. She is the co-founder of the Azire Institute of Research and Education. Over her 50-year career, 50 years, guys, in scientific parapsychology, she has published more than 30 papers alone in collaboration with a number of colleagues in parapsychology and in education. Nancy, I'm so glad you were able to make it today.
Well, thank you so much, Morgan. And you're one of my favorite people in the field too. So we're doing good here.
Oh, that's a very, very high compliment. Thank you very much. Very, very high.
We always always were joyful when we saw you in the chat box of the courses. It was like, yay, Morgan's here.
Oh, that you have no idea how much that means to me, because that is literally how I felt when I was there as well. I was so excited and so passionate. And for those of you guys who are not familiar in the audience here with Paramook, it was an online classroom that all of the best in the field would come and we would talk and present. Nancy, do you want to talk about that a little bit? Because
yeah,
it was, I think, so special.
Carlos and I, when we moved from Virginia Beach down here back to North Carolina, where we had started out our relationship mostly many years before that, we were teaching at the Rhine Research Institute, and it was a lot of fun, but the focus there was on adult education, and so there was a lot of pressure to make things to kind of not dumb them down, but make them a little bit more palatable and for people that didn't have an advanced education. And we thought we were doing that, but we really were looking for this idea of having conferences but have them set up as a course, you know, where you'd have a whole bunch of speakers come in and give talks, but then there would be additional materials and chat and all that stuff and discussion forums, the kind of stuff that you would get with a course. So they were very kind about letting us take off. And we started with a regular conference at the end of 2014 when we were living in a very small cabin in the middle of the woods, and our internet was extremely slow and didn't do a whole lot of uploading and downloading. So we were constantly hyperventilating. And then we started in January of 2015 on our own, the Parapsychology and Research, Parapsychology Research and Education course. And it's called a MOOC because MOOC is a shorthand in education for massively open online courses, basically meaning you're going to have a ton of people in this course and you're not going to ask them to tell you what kind of education they've got. If they're interested, the door is open. And that was kind of the way that we wanted to do things, not even thinking about it. If somebody's interested, they're interested, you know. So I had a colleague who did that for English teachers, people from other countries who taught English, and for people that were interested in virtual world education. And she just would run these amazing conferences with this extra course-like activity going on. And those were our inspirations. The first year we got donations from about a half a dozen people, including the Parapsychology Foundation. And then from 2016 through 2020, Lizette Coley actually financed the course completely, paying us to do the work and paying the expenses as well. So that was really great. We, of course, couldn't do it in 2021 because Carlos was afflicted with a brain cancer probably in September, October of 2020. And he was diagnosed in February of 2021. But he knew in the fall that he was not able to put together the faculty list as he normally did. And we just decided, well, that's okay. We can come back in a couple of years or do it later in 2021, whatever. I'm hoping that in 2022, I can get together with Brian Williams, who was one of our colleagues and collaborators as well from the Psychical Research Foundation, and start it up again. But we'll have to see. I'm moving from North Carolina to Illinois in between, so I'm not sure where I'm going to be.
It's a lot. Well, and I mean, you've always got stuff going on. Like, it's amazing. And the so much of the work that Carlos did was really into the mediumship and ESP side of parapsychology and the paranormal. And that wasn't yours originally. What changed for you?
No, we met. We were both. He was at the University of Virginia working for Dr. Stevenson, who's the reincarnation guy, and who was the main reincarnation researcher of the time. And I was working at the Foundation for Research on the Nature of Man, lovingly called Fernum, which turned later into the Rhine Research Center in Durham. And my boyfriend at the time was not beloved by the staff of the Rhine Center. And one of them happened to visit Dr. Stevenson's unit and came back raving about how Carlos was really wonderful and I would just love him, you know, and all this. And I was kind of like, ugh, leave me alone. And then I went up for the SSE conference, the Society for Scientific Exploration, with my boss, Dr. Ramakrishna Rao, who passed recently, and Dr. Bob Morris. In fact, all these guys are gone. Bob Morris had just gotten the job as the Kursler Professor of Parapsychology at University of Edinburgh, and his mentor, John Beloff, was there too. So my 31-year-old self was sitting in the back seat with all these eminences, driving three hours up to the conference. And what I didn't know was that my colleagues had gotten together with Carlos's colleagues and made sure we met each other. And so to know each other. But he was very much interested in spontaneous experiences, especially mediumship. And because he was able to speak two languages fluently, English and Spanish, and read Italian, Portuguese, and French, he was, from the age of 21, writing articles in the Spanish literature about what was going on in the Anglo-American scene, and for the Anglo-American scene, what was going on in all these other countries, mostly focusing on the 19th century. So when I met him, I think he was hopeful that I was going to, since I'm Italian-American, that I was going to be, you say, be a Palladino. But unfortunately, I'm not only not very psychic, but the only thing I have in common with her is that I'm, you know, retain water and I have a temper.
Did you have any personal experiences with mediumship, or for you was this strictly a study?
No, it was strictly a study. And actually, for Carlos, mediumship was kind of part of the milieu, because like a lot of other Latin American countries, there's a lot of spiritists, you know, the Kardecian tradition from France. In Puerto Rico, and he had friends, and his godmother, who was really psychic, had a lot of psychic experiences of all types, also had friends in the spiritist community. So he had seen a lot of this around him. Once, when we went back to Puerto Rico for Christmas, he had a speaking engagement at one of the spiritist churches. And as he was in the office talking to the, you know, admins about how this was going to work on the next day, I was in their museum, and I swear they had five or six of his early reprints in a museum case with little things on the side saying, our, you know, Puerto Rico's favorite son, you know, and he had no idea that they had even read any of his stuff. But so he was doing that very early on. And I had in college, I had a professor who was an experimentalist, and Brenda Dunn, who was later the laboratory manager and the colleague of Dr. Bob John at Princeton. She was also in that college. And John Bisahar, our professor, was very interested in the experimental side of the side of the field. And poo-pooed all the other stuff, you know, not the spontaneous experiences, right, but anything that might be really wild, like ghost stuff or mediumship. So I had this pro-Reinian prejudice, I think, when I met Carlos. And he felt it was his job to educate me, and he did. Because it didn't take very long before I was balancing the two. And then after a while, I was not doing any experimental work either.
Well,
after
that. I think people, like what you just said, I think you touched on something so important, that, you know, people tend to think that ESP and mediumship and that kind of thing is sort of this very one-dimensional subject matter. And I think a lot of people immediately gravitate towards the idea of sort of the television psychic medium, or, you know, the medium on the street corner that you pay $5 for a reading. And that's just not it at all.
No, exactly.
To me, it's something so multidimensional.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Are interconnected at the very core. I mean, J.B. Ryan and Louisa Ryan, his wife, were graduate students in botany at the University of Chicago when they went to a lecture by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle about his experiences with mediumship in the UK and how he felt about the afterlife and so on. And they were inspired by everything that he said. They both had, you know, a religious background, and they were interested in that, but they did have this kind of different way of looking at things in terms of, yeah, this is the foundational a piece of everything we're trying to do, but this is the modern era. 1927 for them, this was the modern era, and we need to find some way to reduce these amazing complex experiences into something that we can test test in the laboratory. And so that's how the card guessing and all that stuff came along. But periodically they would have conferences. Like they had one conference, I think, in the 50s or the early 60s called incorporeal agency. That was J.B. Rhind's term for mediumship. And they went through a lot of the afterlife kinds of things and the survival, what's now known as survival research. But they were looking for hypotheses for the laboratory rather than wanting to focus on that directly. And I knew from my reading from my own experience, not my personal experiences, but experiences of family members, that, you know, this other milieu is out there and is really important. But I had kind of gone down the Rhinian overemphasize. The Rhinian look at it. And Rhine was never very big in Latin America, to be honest, and not that big in Europe either. It was just interesting. Sort of the Anglo-American context. And there was a certain amount of rivalry between spiritualism and spiritism as well. So he was the very first talk we ever did together was for high school teachers at a teachers conference in Charlottesville, and it had been put together by Stevenson's unit at University of Virginia, and they asked Carlos to ask me if I would do the experimental stuff and he could do the spontaneous and mediumship stuff. So we divided the whole day up into segments, and we had a wonderful time. And it was as listening to him speak from that moment on, everything that he said was very convincing and very interesting and very educational for me too. It kind of broadened my outlook and all that kind of thing. When I wrote about mediumship, like the talk that I gave in 1991 at the Parapsychology Foundation's conference in Dublin on women in parapsychology, I looked at Palladino in the context of women's rights in Italy at the time that she was being discovered and then being tested and so on. And and another one that I did once was to look at a document that was written by a early 19th century minister about how spiritualism was an ism, you know, like fascism and whatever it was, you know, abolitionism. Absolutely. and suffragism. It was one of these things that happened to people when they're women, especially when their uteruses tilt. Which was like, excuse me. You
know? It's but all fun was, and games until your uterus
just goes, yeah, over. So it was really hysterical, but it was a lot of fun, and it was something that kind of came out of our, you know, what we were doing at what we were studying at Duke as well. So I would kind of take a different version of it. But over the years, you know, one thing we shared in common from the very beginning was that the field of parapsychology in the 70s and 80s was not taking experiencers at all seriously. And that's a huge mistake. Even if you've got an experimental point of view, if you're not talking to the people who have these experiences in life, how are you going to learn where they come from, what they mean,
absolutely,
how they work?
Well, and that's just it. Like, not only, you know, is it about, I think, exactly what you're saying, talking to other people, but also the fact that, you know, people have the ability to be able to tap into some of this themselves. And like, yeah. I've always been such a big believer that if you're able to do something, or you've got knowledge or something like that, that ability to then empower other people to do it, I think is so key. And like, what do you think about the idea that this is something that people can start to tap into on their own?
I think, and on one hand, I'm kind of a Rhinian populist that everybody's got it. And it's a question of making the expression of it easier to do, because some of us have personalities and maybe perceptual habits or something that allow us to kind of block out these kinds of things. And Charlie Tart used to say back in the 70s too, and still does, that it's really important for people who are studying things to at least give it a try. You know, we once, Carlos and I once went up to the Monroe Institute for one of these sort of weekend things that they were doing to introduce people to the programs. And neither of us had out-of-body experiences, but we both had altered states of consciousness evoked by the sound that we were hearing and being in the Czechs, you know, these Czech units where you're in this like little enclosed space. And it, and just the, what people were talking about, and it was just really eye-opening for both of us. And it was pretty nifty, I must say. So, I mean, you have to kind of open yourself up to these things. And the other thing is that just being around people who were studying near-death experiences all these years, which we always kept a connection to the University of Virginia unit, you just can't read that stuff without understanding how prevalent it is, how there are universals in those experiences that aren't changed by culture, that there are interesting changes, but, you know, the core of it is the same and has been the same. You know, Corliss had found articles written by clergy in the 1700s about their people who had, you know, died and came back and had these big stories about what was to a modern reader a classic near-death experience. So those kinds of things kind of built in this this sense that survival research was extremely important, that the experiences of the experiences of people who had the ability to express this type of information was extremely important. So when Corliss he had a form of brain cancer that was very aggressive, and we knew it was terminal from the beginning, but we were hoping for more time. When he went into hospice last year, in June, this lovely young Catholic guy came to be our chaplain, and he said, "Well, you know, we don't force anything on anybody. So what is your approach to all these things?" And he looked at me, and I looked at him, and
that's a long story.
I said, "Well, we're eclectic agnostics with a firm belief in the afterlife." And he kind of looked at us like, "Oh, okay." And then he said, "I can work with that." And then later on, we started to talk to him about, you know, we started looking at the bookshelves and all that stuff and saying, "Oh, I get it," you know. But I mean, it grows on you. And I'm grateful because I'm like a rock when it comes to psychic stuff. I've felt a presence, you know, since he's passed. But I'm grateful to one of our students who is a medium in the UK who had an experience with him and sent me an automatic writing piece that she attributed to him, and it was evidential from my perspective, and I was so grateful to hear that, you know. So I, my own sense that he's still there somewhere, was buoyed up by that, and I wasn't above grumping at him before he passed away and saying, "Don't you dare get reincarnated before I get there."
Well, especially after all your work.
I was like, "I want you next time. Get that."
Well, and talking about sort of the classic approach to mediumship and stuff like that, we were talking recently, and I was mentioning earlier in the podcast as well, the work of Dr. William Roll, and the fact that you knew him. And to me, I think he was such a game changer in pulling in not only the classic approaches to mediumship, but then bringing in this new understanding of quantum physics to it, which I found really interesting. Did he shift your views in any way or add to them? Or,
well, me, I think it, I think it was a good, a good set of another grounding in this area that I was just beginning to move towards. And, but Corliss, you know, Corliss was the scourge of the Samuel Weiser, book retrieval, place up in New York City from the age of 14. He was sending books in, you know, book lists in and all that stuff about things that he wanted. Most of the things about mediumship in Europe and all kinds of things. So he already was there, you know, in terms of, okay, we need to have a have a theory that will cover how these things happen and how this fits in the natural world. Because it's obviously that it's evident, it's there. So we have to find a way to accommodate our knowledge to not just dismiss it and walk away kind of thing. So he was already there. And for me, it was, I liked Bill. I thought he was adorable. And he and I were non-Southerners in a Southern complex, context. And yeah, there were moments when we would, you know, he'd say, hey, and I'd say, hey, and then we'd both stop and go, hello, how are you? How are you doing? You know, just to remind ourselves, you know, that I was from the North and he was from Denmark. But it really made an impact on me. And then just in general, reading and editing what Carlos was writing at the beginning and then just reading it later on and all kinds of conversations that we had in his lectures. Our relationship first really started, I mean, we met each other a couple months before that. He came down, like a lot of other people would do, to this summer study program that the Rhine did at the time. And from 1983 to 1993, we were both faculty for that summer program. It was an 8-week program. And it was similar to the Paramook in that a number of people would be brought in to talk about their own work. And then there would be someone who would be there for a whole week kind of a thing. So he was always coming down to show the Stevensonian flag, basically, and give the lectures on mediumship and reincarnation and near-death experiences. And then his specialty, which was out-of-body experiences. That was his, he was especially interested in that from a young age on as well, because of what it might say about the afterlife and whatever it is that might survive. And he did his master's degree at John F. Kennedy in California finished it in the early 1980s by doing a survey on out-of-body experiences. And I think was one of the first people to really focus on the features of the experiences. So that was always in his head. So, and we talked constantly, and we had an experience in New York City when we were waiting for a doctor in a clinic, and the clinic was full of people. So of course the doctor was immensely late, and we were talking about something we were writing. We were both working at the Parapsychology Foundation at that point. That's why we were living in New York. And this girl sitting next to us kept glancing at us. And at one point she said, are you two married? And Carlos was like, yes. And she said, oh my God, I've never seen a married couple talk so much to each other. Oh. I was like, well, I have, not just us, lots of others. I feel sort of sorry for her, but it was really funny. We would get that kind of, there wasn't, we talked shop and we talked life kind of interchangeably for 38 years. So
that's wonderful.
I had quite an education, and I like to think that I opened up some experimental avenues for him, but I have a feeling he already knew about them. It was just that they weren't his favorite.
Just humoring you at that point.
Exactly. Right. Give her a little, let her feel better about it. I mean, when it came to setting up the Paramook and doing the online stuff, then he would be like, what do I push? But
So if someone wants to get a start in exploring ESP and mediumship, do you recommend any literature as a primer? Maybe
I recommend a lot. I mean, one good introduction book that's still out there is Watt and Irwin, and it's an intro to parapsychology in English. It was published by McFarland. It's available on Amazon and all the countries. There are a bunch of books that you can get that are similar to that, and they do a kind of an overview. Now, Caroline comes at it from a fairly skeptical point of view, but they still cover mediumship and things like that as well. Anything by Dean Radin is a great place to start. And Entanglement is one of my favorites, but a lot of his more recent books are fantastic as well. There's always an element of teaching the introductory material to the reader, whoever comes to that. Anything by Julia Musbridge is also amazing. There's a book that she did called Transcendence with Immanence Bruce, who's a Canadian professor. That if you've got a little bit more of a background, you've got experiences of your own, that's a terrific book. I also tell people to become student members of the Society for Psychical Research in London and the Parapsychological Association, which is, I think, based still here in the U.S. They now offer, because of the pandemic and they're keeping it up, lots and lots of low cost online lectures by people who are working in the field. The other one, of course, is the Rhine Education Center through the Rhine Research Center. And their website is just www.rhine.org. And then YouTube is astonishing. I mean, there is an awful lot of material there. All of this, the SPR has a channel, the PA has a channel, the Rhine has a channel. Parapsychology Foundation, which was actually founded in the year I was born. I was almost 1 year old when it was founded. they have a YouTube channel that's extremely good. And what they've had a lecture series since 1992. And then series of lots of filmed conferences and all that kind of stuff. They've done a lot of interviews. Carlos has a lot of introductory material there. He did several intro to parapsychologies in different languages for that channel. But it's a wonderful place to go and just browse because virtually everything is there. For you to see, and some of it being taught by the people who are doing the primary research. The Parapsychology Foundation is also very interesting because the woman who founded it, Eileen Garrett, was Lisette Coley, the current president's grandmother and a medium. And her partner in this enterprise was Frances Payne Bolton, who was a congresswoman in the United States and very wealthy. And she had met Mrs. Garrett because she was interested in those kinds of topics. She had lost a daughter in the 19-teens, and she was open to the idea of mediumship. And Mrs. Garrett had a very interesting approach to her own feeling about what she could do. She was a trance medium, so she wasn't directly connected to the trance process. She would kind of disappear and her controls would come in and take over. But she had lots and lots of regular psychic experiences, dreams and visions and things like that stuff as well. And she was very interested in whether or not there was something wrong with her or was there something real there. Yeah. And of course, she tended towards real, but she was still very intellectually querying all of the things that happened to her. And she wrote a number of really interesting books. One's called Adventures in the Supernormal. That's one of her biographies. Another one, if you're an experiencer yourself, Telepathy is the name of another one of her books, where she talks about how she thinks it works for her and so on. And she always made herself available to the scientists of the day. And the foundation itself has done some enormously good work over the decades. And I think the not only because the Paramook lectures are featured on her channel, but because they're just, that's what they can do right now. They're going through all their film and slowly getting everything up there.
I'm so excited by that too.
Called Parapsychology Online, but I'd go to Parapsychology Foundation first if I were.
Yeah, well, their stuff is so vast and it's so brilliant. Like,
and rich,
that's what
Yeah.
I love their channel for that. And you know, like, I know the Parapsychology Foundation and so many of the foundations and nonprofits and whatnot, they've been hit pretty hard by the restrictions and the rules and things like that. And I really encourage people listening, like, if they can head over there, take a look at the material that's there. Yeah. And it's phenomenal stuff.
Well, and the other thing they're doing besides trying to get all of their historical film up and out there, no matter, you know, what kind of condition it is, if, as long as you can hear what the people are saying and get something out of it, as well as doing new things now and then, is that they're digitizing absolutely all of their publications too, with the idea that they'll be available as well at some point to anybody. And they're wonderful about looking for stuff. You know, if you can't find anything, you can drop a note to Parapsychology Foundation or put a comment on one of the videos and ask for something, and they may be able to find it for you. And they, you know, they have a library and that's out on the North Fork of Long Island in Greenport. And they
it's so invaluable.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the work that they do is astonishing, and they're really wonderful people. I mean, Eileen Garrett founded it, and Eileen Coley, her daughter, was her secretary for a while. And when Eileen Garrett passed away in 1970, Eileen Coley and her husband, Robert Coley, took over. And then when Carlos and I had came in 2000, we started working with them sort of as consultants in 1998. We were living in Puerto Rico at the time. And then we went on site in 2000. At that point, Lizette was the vice president. Her mom was in her 80s. Her dad had, you know, passed away around the time that we moved up. So it was the next handoff, and now Anna Demalis, who is Lizette's daughter, is the person who is working the hardest with Lizette on getting everything done. She's the videographer, and she just does all kinds of great stuff. And then her brother George is on the board, so it's still a family. A family legacy to which they're all devoted, and a wonderful, wonderful resource.
Yeah, I think people are so in need of this now. Yeah. Because you know, we're just inundated with so many of these kind of thriller, entertainment, ghost hunting type things that this stuff tends to get lost, and I think the real legitimate stuff gets sort of mocked or pushed to the side because people think,
it's usually not so exciting as, you know,
there's magic in here. And like you were mentioning Dean Radin's books, and like one of his books that I just love was Real Magic.
And yes, and that's marvelous. Yeah.
It's so marvelous. And I think so much of the magic in what's here and what we get to look at and research and experience there, it is the real magic of the universe to me. And that's what makes this stuff so amazing.
Exactly. And I would also say, like, if somebody is interested in ghost hunting, Lloyd Auerbach is teaching in every single semester in the Ryan Education program. And some of it has to do with ghost hunting techniques and all that kind of thing. And then he also teaches a credit course at Atlantic University that's an introductory course. And then if you're interested in mediumship, the Winbridge Institute in Tucson, Arizona, where Julie Bischel. I just went through a whole list of people named Julie, but Julie Bischel and her husband, Mark Bacuzzi, they mainly focus on mediumship and have had experiences themselves, but he comes out of the ghost hunting tradition as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
And just to blow my own horn, not that I had anything to do with the writing, but I did do the production. Parapsychology Foundation published Tony Cornell's book back in the day, I think in the end of the 90s, called Investigating the Paranormal. And he and Alan Gold, who's a retired professor from the University of Nottingham, started doing field investigations in 1955. And the two of them did some really amazing work. And Tony's book was just wonderful. And you can see on the PF's YouTube channel a whole day that was put together for the launch. And Carlos was a speaker, and Lloyd Auerbach was a speaker. And
that's exciting.
Hans Holzer was a friend of the family, and he was the speaker. And then Tony Cornell. And there I think there's at least three YouTube videos about that day. And that's a heck of a book. I mean, I had a lot of fun doing the page production for, because I was like the desktop publishing lady over there, with Mrs. Garrett's work, because she was so self-reflective and intentional and just fascinating. But I was also blown away by Tony Cornell and the breadth of experience that he and Alan had from 1955 up to the 90s.
Absolutely.
So just because a book is like ancient doesn't mean it isn't wonderful.
That's exactly, which is like pretty much the mantra we need to apply in life.
Yes, exactly right.
This has been wonderful. Thank you so much for being here, because I know for a fact the audience has been thoroughly educated in this, which I think is drastically needed. Mm-hmm. And Mike, you had another question to wrap this up.
Yeah, I did. If there's one thing you wish people could take away from your teaching on these subjects, what would that be?
That science can handle anything, but science also needs nature and experience in the mix when you're thinking about what's happening, and that this is a very, very important topic for people, because so many people have these experiences just because science has not been collectively positive about them at different eras across the centuries, doesn't mean that they don't exist. They just keep coming. And the content of these experiences and the structure of these experiences and how they impact people's lives, that stays the same. So that means there's a reason to be curious and a reason to be intellectually interested in all of these experiences.
I couldn't have put it better myself.
Yeah.
Really, thank you so much for doing this and for being here and talking about wonderful Carlos and everything. And we're just, thank you.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity, because this is the first time that I've talked about him, and I'm sure I'm going to go knit for about 3 hours now, because I'm emotionally, hit in the head. But he was an incredible person. I mean, he started so young being interested and published his first journal article at 21, over 350 journal articles in his whole life. And for a 44-year career, he did about what a normal 90-year-old might have done. And, you know, he just crammed it all in, and he still loved to, go antiquing and was mad for Marvel movies. And, we did not miss a single Marvel movie. So he knew how to live life and as well as dive into this amazing experience filled area of study and do incredibly good work around that. And I still don't know how I got this lucky to find this guy and have him want to marry me, but he had a wonderful, important life and curiosity and the willingness to drag science along with him, but to listen to people and care what they were saying. That really was Carlos. So
beautiful.
Yeah.
Beautiful. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you, Morgan, and thank you, Mike. It's been nice talking to you.
Thanks. You too. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And we're done.
I think so.
That was wonderful. Stuff. Believing that it's existing and things like that. And it's just, I'm so grateful that we did this today.
And I have to ask you a favor. I totally forgot about the four interviews you did with Jeff Mischloff in New Thinking Aloud. And that's another great channel.
We'll add in the links. Send me all the links, everything.
I will.
Yep. I'll add them to the show notes for the show. And
I'll go. Yep. I have to do that anyway for this document that I have a terrible feeling is on my computer in the shop. I can certainly make the list. I can certainly make the list of the videos that I hadn't started on the videos yet, so I can do that for you today.
Yeah, that would be great, because we'll repost everything and I'll spam the internet with the everything. So
and I think this episode will be the one that is released on January 3rd.
Nice. Our 33rd anniversary would have been the 2nd.
Oh, wow.
No way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, well, that was meant to be.
Is that right? Let me think about that for a second. What year is this? No, the 32nd. The 32nd anniversary.
Yeah.
That was meant to be.
There's no such thing as a coincidence.
No, there sure isn't.
Yeah, no, there isn't. That's for sure.
No, it all lines up exactly where it needs to be.
See, so you coming into Paramook was really important. And honest to God, Mike, I'm sure this will not surprise you. Morgan was the best chatter in the chat box.
Oh, yeah.
Always informative, always enthusiastic. It was just wonderful to have her.
I do a true crime podcast and dark history and that kind of stuff. And I brought Morgan on to talk about the Great Amherst Mystery in Nova Scotia. We just kind of hit it off so well. I knew one day we'd end up doing something together. So,
oh yeah, well,
send me an email with the links to these podcasts. So I can stick them on my list.
Great,
oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Because I mean, honest to God, if I'm not doing this, I'm watching NCIS. So, yep.
Oh, Dark Poutine will be perfect for you. Yeah. Oh yeah, Dark Poutine. It's amazing. Like it's so amazing. It's so informative. Like Mike he had a book just come out in November based on the podcast, and it's stellar. Yeah, it's stellar, and the stories are so phenomenal, and they're just like make your skin crawl in the best way. So,
yeah. And it's a bestseller on Amazon Unexplained Mysteries right now. So.
Oh, lovely! I'll go look for it. Oh, that's
you act
great.
Like you're surprised, Mike. Like, yeah. Stop being surprised.
Well, I do feel surprised. I know that I've had our podcast, Dark Poutine, has had like 14 million downloads. So
Wow, yeah. Fantastic.
I just wish I could convert those to a dollar or even a penny.
Dollar per download, that'd be okay.
Yeah, that would be okay. Yeah, exactly.
No. Maybe.
But, yeah, no. But yeah, like I love being able to do the supernatural circumstances because I love the fact that like we get to use the platform for so much.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's what I really, really love about this. I was actually talking to Lizette Coley a few days ago and whatever, because I want to have her on to talk about not only the foundation, but Eileen Garrett as well. And I'm gonna
she's Julie wonderful. Come on. She's such a close. We were so lucky. We went to New York in 1986 because Carlos was a voting member at the ASPR, and we went over just to say hello to the people at the PF. And her father, who was a character himself, he was a Spitfire pilot in World War II. He came downstairs to grab us to bring us upstairs, and we came into the room with her mom and Lizette. And the first thing out of Mrs. Coley's mouth was, "I've been watching you." And they had asked Carlos to come and do a conference and all that kind of stuff, and so we were totally in awe of them. And I had asked them for a grant when I was just gotten out of my undergraduate, and I got turned down because I didn't have a master's. And I thought, and Lizette was very ashamed that A, she turned me down, and then kind of flummoxed that the reason why I decided I had to go to graduate school was because of her letter. And I always kind of blame them for getting me on the back on the path, basically, which they thought was funny. But it was wonderful to work for them. And then when we came up to New York, all of a sudden we were part of the family. Just marvelous and super close friends. And she's she's one of my widow whisperers. I have Bob Morris's widow and her, and then a cousin in Brenda Dunn, who have all lost people in the last so many years. And Bob died quite a while back, but it's wonderful to be able to write somebody an email and say, "I don't know what to do with myself." And Brenda said, "Are people asking you to do interviews and write things?" And I said, "Yes." She said, "Say yes."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know? Yep.
And then Lizette has had other kinds of, you know, I'm getting this like four-prong batch of incredibly good advice from people who've been in this situation before with men that they love to bits and, you know, was the only guy. So, and I used to tell them at the end that brain cancer has a tendency to make people suspicious. And one day I had the Got Junk guys over here to clean out one of our outside closets so that I could move all of my correspondence out there so that I could spread out his, because we had already started talking to the University of West Georgia, who are taking his papers. And Or, I mean, I'm not sure if that was true. I think it was some other reason. There was other reason why I wanted to get all of his papers in one spot, because I don't think I talked to them until after he passed away. But I came into the room and he thought I had a boyfriend and I was going to pack up and leave him.
Oh, no.
And I, you know, he'd never been insecure about our relationship. And I sternly told him that, no, I wasn't going anywhere. And besides, my profession for the rest of my life is going to be La Viuda Alvarado, which means the widow Alvarado.
Right.
And he got this big smile on his face like, well, you don't have to necessarily do that. But boy, yeah. It's okay. You know. No, he got rid of his suspicion really quickly. We were really lucky because people with that particular problem tend to lose their personalities. And he did not. He was kind and curious and loving and just beautiful to everybody around him right up to the last day.
Yeah, I had an incident in the summer in August with a dear friend of mine who has schizoaffective disorder.
Oh.
And went off off his medication. And it was very similar where he believed that I was sending him messages through my Facebook wall that I was basically out to get him and whatever. And it was really intense. And I basically ended up leaving him a really nice letter, like a really nice email, basically saying like the door is open for you and whatever. But really, like, there's no words that can bring them out of that. You know, it's something I think that they have to come to that conclusion on their own.
Yeah, and he got it. I mean, my first reaction was like, they were 20 years old. They could be my kids, for God's sake, you know? And he was like, okay, what's wrong with that picture?
Yeah.
And then we went on with the conversation, but it was the first time in my whole life that he said anything like that. And later on, the doctor said, well, actually, you're really lucky that he was okay with it afterwards, because some of them just can't get out of that.
Yeah.
And one of the nurses, her brother had died of glioblastoma, too, about 2 years or 3 years before that. And she said he was totally suspicious of everybody in the family and angry with everybody in the family the last few months he was alive. And it was really hard on them because he had not at all been that way. As in his real life. And Carlos was just sweet as hell. He was his own self right straight through, and everybody loved him, and he knew all their names and
wonderful.
Wanted to know how their kids were doing and knew their names. And even if he was forgetting, you know, what he ate at breakfast, or some cousin that he hadn't seen in 50 years, he knew the people around him and what he needed to talk to them about. So that was a big blessing too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So, but anyway, thank you guys. This is a breakthrough for me, because I've been really afraid to do anything. Like, I had to do that. I put a YouTube video up on my teaching online YouTube channel, thanking my university for giving me a teaching award, and I had to mention that, you know, that Carlos had passed, and it took me like 6 tries to get something that wasn't completely ridiculous. So this is good. I was, and I'm doing the William Roll talk in the end of February, I think, early March.
I think that's wonderful, and Christine's the one to do it with.
Yeah, Christine is terrific. Carlos always talked to all of her courses when he was, you know, doing well. She'd have him in on an online thing to do a talk about his research to her students.
What's your kitty's name?
This one is Pinky, the one that just made the noise.
Oh,
that's Pinky, and Spotty is sound asleep. Carlos named all of our cats. The first two were Alva and Zing, you know, Alvarado and Zingroni.
Mm-hmm.
And the second cat batch were Lita and Lota. And Lita was short for Peluita, which means hairy in Spanish, because she had a lot of hair. She was a Maine Coon cat.
Oh,
and the other one was called Peluta because she was a American Standard, very long and skinny, except she had this really round belly, and Pelota is a ball. So I've never had any possibility of naming our cats. Pinky has a pink nose and Spotty has a spot on her nose. So.
Pinky sounds very Pinky friendly.
I know, hey?
Yeah.
Well, they always made a Paramook appearance at some point. Yeah. Like, yeah, either, they're always there. Either you could hear a meow, or it was, they were there somewhere. But
Well, the first two I wanted to call Charlotte and Emily, and he was, no. Alba and Bing. Okay. All right.
That's so awesome. Cute.
Yeah. So, of course, they were in the first line of the automatic writing, basically.
Yeah.
I met my favorite felines was in the first line.
So Morgan, you'll send links to Nancy's where she can find everything, and
absolutely.
Thank you, and I'll after I go to the bathroom, I'll come back and start making you a list of links.
Awesome,
that would be fantastic because we will, as I say, share the crap right out of that. So
okay,
and I'm sending you a link to the podcast, our website here right now.
Oh, great, thank
you. Have that. I will. This is wonderful. And I will talk to you guys very soon.
Well, thank you very much. It was nice meeting you, Mike.
Yes, nice to meet you too, Nancy. All the best. Here's Morgan for this episode's segment of Spiritual Healthcare.
In this episode's edition of Spiritual Healthcare, the segment of the show where you get to be the creator and designer of your paranormal and spiritual experience, we're going to tell you about a process called Could You Imagine If? This process was started by my colleague and best friend, Stephanie Wirtz, and myself when we were just teenagers back in high school. We would have conversations about all sorts of things that would begin with the phrase, what if, or could you imagine if? Usually it centered around our dreams of what we wanted for our company, Entity Seeker. No, what if was too crazy or too big. We were just playing, but what we noticed was that those could you imagine ifs were beginning to show up in our experience. Sometimes it wouldn't be until a year later, but gradually we began to see that even the most impossible things appeared in situations where the essence of our what if was present. We would have fun with it, let our conversations run wild, and then let it go with no timeline on our expectation. Sometimes we would forget about it altogether until it began to happen. So we would encourage you to get out a journal. Choose a subject that you don't have too much resistance in, but that you'd like to move into reality. And begin with, could you imagine if? Or wouldn't it be nice if? You don't have to justify it. Just feel how it would feel with those results. Gradually, you'll begin to shift your emotional state on each one of these subjects. And as you do, you allow those probabilities to begin to realize into your experience. The most important thing is to have fun with it. Do it for the fun, not the outcome, and watch what happens. You need nothing to be happy, but you need something to be sad. And remember, at the end of seeking, all is consciousness. Stay in peace, everyone.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Supernatural Circumstances, a co-production of Entity Seeker Paranormal Research and Teachings, and Good Egg Studios. This podcast is part of the Curious Cast podcast network. Theme music by Corey Johnson of Catalyst Records in Edmonton, Alberta. You can find out more about Morgan Knudsen at entityseeker.ca and more about me and listen to my other show at darkpoutine.com. Feel free to email the show at supernaturalcircumstances@gmail.com. Good night for now.